supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, many of you are enjoying rhubarb right now, making those rhubarb pies and tasty puddings, and probably most, if not all of you, are in a cold climb. Well, what do you do when rhubarb is a precious family heirloom plant, but you have to move down to where it's hot and dry? We'll try and help a family move around that dilemma after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. And welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be on your program to get this question answered for me.
Okay.
I live out in Media, and I no longer have any daffodils, but folks around me do, and I see them bundling the leaves and putting a rubber band around them. And from what I understand, the leaves should be left to synthesize with the sun and just rot away and not be bundled up. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Bulbs in bondage is like a terrible idea. People have this thing where they just don't want to allow the plants to behave the way they need to behave, the way they naturally behave. In nature, spring bulbs like daffodils and tulips and crocus, they appear naturally in the most godforsaken parts of this planet, where the winters are freezing cold and snow-covered, and the summers are blisteringly hot and dry, which is why these plants have developed this lifestyle of hiding underground almost all the time. But there's that very brief period of time in spring when the snow melts and the soil warms up that it's safe for the plant to come up above ground, let loose the flower that it's been holding inside of itself all winter long, and then those green leaves, they luxuriate in the sunshine, and those green leaves, exactly as you said, they gather up and they store all of this solar energy. After the flower is spent, after the tulip is gone, after the daffodil flower is gone, now we enter the most important part of a bulb's life. Because now, during this period of time when its leaves are nice and green, that's when it's growing the following year's flower inside of itself. Now, people who make the worst mistakes, they just mow over the leaves because they don't want to look at them, or the flower's gone, so it's not pretty anymore. And what happens with those people is the next year it sends up leaves again, but no flower.
Right.
And of course they blame the bulb or the bulb supplier, or go to the store and buy a bag of chemicals for fun or something. But it is this time of year that bulbs should be fed, should allow their green leaves to be fully open, collect all the solar energy possible. I think this bulbs in bondage thing came about when people realized that the leaves had to absorb solar energy, but these types of gardeners don't want anything out of place. They don't want anything that looks floppy or isn't perfectly centered in their garden. So they got this weird idea of tying up the leaves, which is the worst of both worlds. Daffodils, tulips, crocus, all the spring bulbs, they need to have their greenery left in place. But as soon as that greenery changes the least bit of colors, as soon as it starts to yellow, it's not photosynthesizing anymore.
Right.
So then you can get rid of it. And if you want to plant flowers in that same spot, that's very understandable. Most of us garden in smaller spaces than we like. But once the green leaves have changed color and you've removed them, if you want to plant other plants on top, the smartest thing is to actually dig up the bulbs.
Yes.
Bring them inside, store them in a cool, dark place. Then you can grow all the annuals you want. You can feed and water them, and it won't rot the bulbs underneath.
Right.
And then right after Halloween, take those bulbs out of storage and plant them fresh again. That is the best way to ensure return bloom.
Yes, well, I'm sorry that I learned this, you know, now that I'm 80, instead of when I was younger. But I would just, you know, like to pass the information on to some other folks that I see they're bundling up the leaves. And somebody else that I know has her gardener mow them down. And miraculously, her daffodils are coming back. I don't know how it's happening. I keep telling her, don't let them do that. But they still come back. So they must have been very strong bulbs. But they'll die off eventually. They won't give blooms.
Daffodils are tough plants, but you do that once with tulips and you'll never see a flower again.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I really appreciate your show. I love all the information that you give.
Well, thank you for providing some of that information this week.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you very much again.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Aubrey, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing good, Aubrey. How are you, sir?
I'm good.
And where is Aubrey good?
I'm in Richmond, Virginia.
Okay, very good. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, I'm a novice at best, Mike, novice gardener at best. I got a decent lawn and some roses coming and so on, but I'm really a novice. I was listening to you Saturday morning a couple of weeks ago, and you talked about several things. A couple of them I just have a question about.
Sure.
One is a treatment for mosquitoes. You mentioned a particular treatment. It started with the letter D. It was an acronym, D, some T, something.
Okay. So there is a basic organic substance called BT, B for boy. BT stands for Bacillus thuringiensis. It's a large group of soil-dwelling organisms, many of which have surprisingly helpful properties in the world of agriculture and pest control. BTI, Baker Tommy Israel, is the substance that you buy. You've seen these donut-shaped dunks in the hardware stores that you throw into.
Sure.
That's BTI. You throw that into a pond, and it prevents mosquitoes from breeding there for 30 days. You can also buy BTI in the form of little charcoal briquettes, and you can even get it in granular form. And you use it to treat any standing water you can't dump out. But especially early in the season, you can leave out buckets of water that you've treated with BTI, and female mosquitoes will lay their first clutches of eggs in those buckets, but the eggs won't hatch. So it's actually a very effective way to kind of trap mosquitoes in that you're ending their life cycle.
Okay, great information. The other thing is you mentioned a mixture for planting, mulch, vermiculite, and a third component.
Over the past couple of shows, we've been paying tribute to the late Mel Bartholomew, who created square foot gardening, where in the early days, Mel said to dig up your garden and get rid of your lousy soil and replace it with, quote, Mel's mix. Later in life, Mel decided that nobody needs that much work. So he said, just to level off your existing soil, drop your raised bed frames over top of it and fill the raised bed frames with this, quote, Mel's mix, which is a loose, light, soil-free mix. Now, what it essentially comes down to, the original Mel's mix was one-third compost, one-third vermiculite, which is a specialty substance used to lighten up soil, and one-third peat moss, which is also very light and loose. It has antibiotic properties, and it both drains well and retains water, which is a cool trick. Now, I prefer perlite to vermiculite simply because years ago there was asbestos contamination of some mixtures of vermiculite. Now, I've been assured that doesn't happen anymore, but ever since then, I've only used perlite, and I love it. And perlite is, if you ever buy plants from the garden center and you think there's little styrofoam balls in the dirt,
Yeah. That's
perlite. That's actually a mined volcanic glass that's popped and it's a great way to lighten up the soil. The whole point of raised bed gardening, a Mel's mix of square foot gardening, is you make a very light, loose soil mixture for your plants so that their roots get lots of air and water and nutrients, and then you don't step in those raised beds. You don't compress that soil down.
Okay. Those were the questions I had. You answered them as you always do, and I appreciate the call. Thanks very much.
Well, they're good questions, and I'll just remind you and everybody, if they hear something on the show, they can go to the show's website, youbetyourgarden.org, click on Garden Answers A to Z, and under Mosquitoes, M for Mosquitoes, you'll find lots of information on BTI. And under R for raised beds, you'll find lots of options on what to fill your raised beds with and what to make the frames out of.
Great. Thanks very much, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. Have fun gardening.
All right.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at noon and 2 on Sunday, June 26th at the Burlington County Earth Fair, discussing pests, weeds, and disease, how to keep your mid-season garden going strong. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with hot times for cool plants and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what do you do if your most treasured family heirloom plant are clumps of rhubarb in your cold climate property, and you have to move to an area whose summers are too hot for rhubarb to survive? We'll solve this dilemma after lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Jack. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I need some help with my asparagus.
Okay. Where is Jack's asparagus?
I'm in Haddon Heights, New Jersey, right across the river from Philly.
All right. So what's wrong with Jack's asparagus?
So this was our fourth year. So we were, you know, excited about having a good harvest this year. The plants did well the first 3 years. We really didn't harvest anything, you know, following guidelines. And around this area, I think it was mid-April or maybe even towards late April, when the first shoots started to come in for the season, we got a snow.
Mm-hmm.
And it may have been an inch or so, I can't recall, but it was a very wet snow. And subsequently, the asparagus just disappeared. So I don't know if it got hammered by the snow and couldn't recover, or exactly where we're at with it. I was hoping you could guide me.
So you had spears that were starting to emerge?
Correct.
And after the snow melted, you didn't find withered, blasted plants or little spears? They were gone?
Correct.
What's the possibility that mice or voles or rabbits ate them?
Rabbits, certainly. I haven't seen any behavior that would suggest mice or voles, you know, but the stalks are still there, right? The base of the plant, but they're all, you know, they're brown and you know how they get in the winter, and they just never turned after those first spears start coming in.
You have a patch where a couple of spears started to come up and then nothing.
Correct.
And no replacement spears, nothing coming up now, for instance.
No. So I took the one, the roots on the end, the weakest of the bunch, you kind of excavated as far down as I can go just with my finger, and it was soaked all the way down to the roots of the plant, just soaking wet.
Oh, okay. So, in other words, the area has poor drainage.
I don't know. It's not a raised bed. However, the way I have the soil constructed, it's 2 feet higher than the rest of the ground around it.
Okay, that's unusual. Generally, asparagus is a crop that's planted in flat ground because it's a perennial. You want it to be, you know, at the normal level in the ground for winter frost protection.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely higher than the rest of the ground around it.
But you're saying you excavated one of the old crowns and it's rotted?
Yes.
I'm sorry, that's what happened. Asparagus, rhubarb, all these plants, they need good drainage. And, you know, last year we got almost a record amount of rain. We got 52 inches of rain in your area. And in normal years or light years, your poor drainage wouldn't have bit you in the rear. But I think that's the likely excuse for what happened, is that it just got too wet, stayed too wet for too long. Because typically, even if you had crowns come up that were frost damaged or something like that, or even if mice, rats, squirrels, rabbits, anything ate them, there would always be new shoots coming up. If you have no shoots of any kind from this season, your bed is dead, Jim.
Oh, breaks my heart. Breaks my heart. We were so excited to have a great harvest this year.
Yeah, no, it is a sin because you did invest that amount of time in it. If you do want to try it again, you want to plant them at ground level. You really want to loosen up that soil and enrich it as well. You really want to. This is a great use for well-composted horse manure, for perlite. Make sure not a raised bed, but on high ground, an area that really drains well. And if you go to our website and read our tips on planting asparagus before you try it again, this is kind of unusual that it would go for 3 or 4 years and then something like this happen. You know, it's possible there was a disease, but what you're describing is soaking wet soil and rotten roots. That's poor drainage. Asparagus just can't survive it. So if you want to do it again, look for an area with good drainage and read up on our tips. And don't give up, because if you get an area that drains well, you should be able to, you know, get good harvests.
Yeah, I will. And I apologize, Mike. What's that web address?
Go to youbetyourgarden.org. And click on Garden Answers A to Z, and asparagus is right there under the letter A.
Okay, great. Well, love your show. Really appreciate your help.
All right, good luck, sir.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. George, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. George, how are you, sir?
I'm well, thanks.
Where is George well?
I'm in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Okay, just outside of Philadelphia.
Yes.
What can we do for you, George?
Well, the reason I call you is because I need an opinion, advice. My wife and I, we bought a house from the Chester County Historical Society 10 years ago. We restored, et cetera. It's right in the center of town. It's an acre of land. But the house is historical, and the person who owned the house in the 1800s was David Townsend, and he was an arborist. As a matter of fact, I believe there's a flower named after him, the Townsendia or something. So anyway, he planted beautiful species, and there's some left, and one of them is a weeping cherry tree, and it's just gorgeous. It's probably over 200 years old. It's 40 feet tall or more, 45. The circumference of the trunk is 8 to 10 feet. As you can imagine, it's a beautiful tree, and when it flowers this time of the year. So the other day, the person who mowed my lawn told me that the tree is dead in the top. So we look at it, and what happens is, in the top of the tree, probably halfway through, the tree splits on two branches, two big trunks, one on the right, one on the left. The one on the left is beautiful, flowering, etc. The one on the right, a little bigger, is dead. It's nothing, grows. All the branches are bare. And
George,
is laying, is,
George,
is
wait
laying
a minute.
Top of the,
George,
yes.
How far up the tree does this split occur?
I would say probably 25 feet or something.
Okay, so on one side, is it fair to say that the majority of the tree appears dead, and on the other side, it looks pretty lively?
Yes, I will say 50% dead, and the other 50% is lovely, yes.
But it's not dead specifically at the point where the tree splits off. There's still some good green growth coming out of the bottom of the bad side.
No.
No,
nothing
no.
is coming on the bad side.
It's okay.
The bad side is bad.
So you want to know whether to cut off the bad part or cut it down?
Well, yes, I was advised to take it down, but in honesty, it's a 200-year-old tree, and I have a lot of respect for it. So I want to know any way we can save it or cut the bad part out, or maybe it's hollow inside. I have no idea. That's not my field.
Well, you can cut the bad part off, and you can save it. And I understand your respect for a 200-year-old tree. But that 200-year-old part also means the tree is probably nearing the end of its life. Now, you got to be honest with yourself. Take a good look at this tree. What would it look like with the one side? Do you think a talented arborist could make it look like something resembling a tree? Or would it be Eric the half a tree?
We did imagine that. And I think it's going to look pretty awkward.
Well, you know, first of all, if it's an historic property, you probably want to get the people on the Historical Society in on this to discuss what's going to be done. I will tell you that it is very expensive to remove trees, to work on trees like this. They're going to have to bring in a crane. So whatever you get done, you want to get it done once. So I'm going to suggest you contact a certified arborist. This is an arborist that's certified with the National Group of Arborists. Have him look at the tree or her and estimate the remaining life of the tree. You may wind up realizing that if you don't cut this thing down, it's just going to fall apart on you in a couple of years. And you don't want the double expense of having people come out and work on it twice. My best suggestion for you,
yes,
especially because it's this time of year, contact some local horticulturalists, some people who have garden centers, maybe even PHS. There is an historical tree society that propagates trees like this. This would be a good time of year for them to take cuttings and make clones of the original tree. Then, once the clones are propagated, once you realize you've got healthy branches from the good side and you've got a number of ones that look like they're going to take, have this done professionally, then I think the smart money does say to remove the old tree, if possible, have the stump pulled as well, and then perhaps replant not just one, but maybe a small grove of the saplings that would be clones of the tree, that would still be the same tree, that would have its DNA, that would carry on its heritage. Then you've got, like, I realize, you know, you're starting over again, but then you've got historical markers saying on this site a 200-year-old tree died, but before it died, we took cuttings from it, yeah. And this is the same tree being carried on. I think in terms of respecting the tree's history and the magnificence of these flowering cherries, and also the fact that we're still in a good time to take cuttings, I think you can duplicate this tree and have the old one removed before it kills somebody.
Yeah, I think that, I didn't think about it. And what you were mentioning about cloning. And the other thing that makes me think that you're right, I have to cut it because the dead branch is kind of leaning over the main electric line that comes into Westchester.
Okay. Well, then call in the power company. They may want to take it down for you.
Well, okay. I'll give it a try.
All right, George.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call, and
right.
I really enjoy your program.
All right. Well, thank you for caring so much about this tree. I think we can keep it alive in a different form.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Dominic, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing good. Dom, how are you, sir?
I'm pretty good.
And where is Dom pretty good?
Right outside of Philadelphia in Roxborough.
Oh, okay, sure, by the giant radio towers.
Yeah, not too far.
All right. Mm-hmm. Actually, Roxborough is a hot little neighborhood out there. That's a nice place to live.
It is. I love it.
What can we do for Dominic in Roxborough?
Well, I have a vegetable garden in my yard, and over the past 3 or 4 years, I've been having an encroaching Canadian thistle problem. It seems like it's starting to take over more and more every year, and the more I pick it and weed it, it just comes back stronger. So I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Well, Roxborough is a very crowded area, not a lot of growing space. Is this a backyard garden?
It's a backyard, and I'm more towards the suburban part of Roxborough.
Okay, so you got
like upper Roxborough, so I have a big yard.
Oh, okay. And are you flat earth or raised bed?
Flat earth.
And where is the thistle coming from? Is it coming from the woods? Is it coming from a lawn?
There's a lawn and there's a stone wall.
Right.
It's pretty close, and it's coming from there.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think this is your big excuse to move up to raised beds. There's absolutely no advantage to growing in flat earth. And
okay.
Have you even done anything to improve the soil or anything? Or are you just futzing around?
Yeah,
out there?
I mostly put leaf mulch down, broken leaf compost down, and I have a friend who has chickens, and we put some chicken manure on the beds as well.
Okay, well, be careful with the chicken manure. You know that is a good fertilizer for sweet corn and lawns, but it's not a good fertilizer for flowering plants.
Okay. Well, I usually do. It's like a vegetable garden. Oh, okay. No, so flowering plants. Okay.
Right. Horse manure and chicken manure are high in nitrogen. That makes big plants, mm-hmm. but inhibits flowering.
Okay.
What I want you to do is take a look at your garden, and whether you do this the square foot method or the raised bed method, you mm-hmm. sketch out areas that are no wider than 4 feet, but they can be as long as you want them to be. And then mm-hmm. you can frame that out with wood, with pavers. If you live near woods, sometimes old fallen trees make great rough kind of rustic raised bed frames. But on the ground itself, you're going to level the ground out, and you're going to lay down a single sheet of cardboard.
Okay.
And then you're going to put your raised bed frames over top of the cardboard. You're going to fill them with nice, rich compost, and I would urge you to mix in maybe a little bit of screened black topsoil and some perlite to loosen up the soil.
Okay.
Make sure you have walking lanes that are 2 foot wide in between your raised beds and cover those with something. Cover those with cardboard and then wood chips to keep the thistle from coming up there.
Mm-hmm.
You will find the raised beds to be so productive. You're never going to till again, because you're never going to step in the soil in these raised beds. They're going to be much more productive than your flat earth garden. You won't lose all your soil in a heavy rain, and the cardboard will prevent the existing thistle from coming up. Now, as it's coming at you from the sides, so to speak, as it's marching towards your garden, don't pull it out. That something about pulling thistle encourages it. But you now recognize the plant, right? You know what it looks like. Do not let it flower. Either mow it down as soon as the little plants appear or prune it off at the soil line. Do that repeatedly. Keep pruning it off or cutting it down. Don't allow the plant to develop leaves that can photosynthesize, and you'll eventually starve out the root system.
Okay.
But
I'll give it a shot.
Like, yeah, it's time to move up to 20th century gardening. You're gardening back in, like, the Jethro Tull method, and I don't mean
that. I still plow with a draft horse, too.
Yeah, I believe it. This is a great excuse to move up to raised beds, and the cardboard barriers will solve all your problems, and you just need to be vigilant and remember to cut, not pull.
Okay, cut, not pull. Thanks,
yes.
Mike. Appreciate it.
All right, good luck, Tom.
Yeah, thanks for the advice. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to announce that I'll appear at noon and 2 on Sunday, June 26th at the Burlington County Earth Fair in Burlington County, New Jersey. I'll be talking about how to keep your summertime garden going strong. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with hot times for cool plants and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will try to help a family with a seemingly impossible situation. They have family heirloom rhubarb plants that are priceless to them that are delivering those special springtime stalks right now. But they have to move down to hot and dry Oklahoma, where rhubarb can't survive the summers. How are we going to keep these heirlooms in the family? We'll let you know after a couple more of these fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Mary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Great to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you, Mary. Where are you?
I'm in Collingswood, New Jersey.
So what can we do for Mary in the Garden State?
I have a large camellia, Mike. It's approximately 40 foot and approximately 40 years old. But it has a lot of yellowing leaves and it's dying off. Now, there is some shoots growing at the bottom of it. And early last month, I fed it organic holly tone, but it doesn't seem to have made any difference.
Mm-hmm.
This began last year. It started showing signs of yellowing and dropping.
And what have you done for this tree in the previous decades? Has it been fed, mulched? Has it?
Yes. Every year I give it the organic holly tone.
Right.
The ground itself has right dress on it.
Okay. And right dress is a licorice root mulch.
That's right.
Okay. But you've been doing that for years and years.
Well, yeah, I would say in the last 10.
Yeah. And nothing else has changed about the area. It's not getting more sun, less sun, the drainage.
Oh, yes. Now, about 5 years or 6 years ago, there was an old tree on the other side, my neighbor's property, and he cut it down. But that's been gone for many years.
Okay.
Maybe 10, maybe not that many, but it has been gone.
Okay. Well, camellias are southern plants. They can take a good amount of sun in New Jersey. I do not recommend any of these wood mulches. I know that the licorice root people would like you to think it's different than a wood mulch. It's really not.
Okay.
The licorice, you know, it's a tree that they grind down to get the licorice extract. And
okay.
It is just wood mulch. Camellias, it's lesser known than azaleas and rhododendrons, but camellias are what we call acid-loving plants. And you've been trying to acidify the soil using holly tone, which is an organic fertilizer, granular fertilizer, that also contains elements to keep the soil acidic. And yellowing leaves, to me, is always a sign that the pH of the soil is wrong. I had a similar situation with an azalea that was right out in front of my house, and I thought, oh, man, now my neighbors really know I don't know how to do this stuff. But I saw the yellowing leaves and thought, you know, I haven't done anything to make the soil acidic in a while. So I got one of those bricks of milled peat moss.
Yeah.
And spread it out underneath the azalea, covered that with a little bit of compost, and then kind of, you know, hoped for the road to be blocked by falling trees until it recovered. Well, in 24 hours, the plant had greened up again completely. They really like a peaty, rich soil. So I'm going to suggest you rake away all the right dress from that area, especially. Replace it with 1 inch of milled peat moss. You know what I mean by milled peat moss, right?
No, I know what peat moss is. I've seen it in the big bags.
Well, yeah, in the bricks and stuff. Yes, and inside you'll find it's, quote, milled. It's very fine.
Yeah.
So you spread that around the base of the plant. You can't really go overboard with it. And then cover that with a little bit of compost. But keep wood mulch away from plants like camellias, azaleas, and rhododendrons, and for different reasons from roses.
Okay.
But I think if you put down peat moss, cover it with compost, I think your camellia will probably perk right up. I think you'll be astonished at how quickly those leaves can green up again.
Okay. Well, thanks ever so much, Mike.
All right. Well, thank you, Mayor. Let us know how it works out.
I will.
Okay?
Thank you.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Daryl, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, glad to be on with you.
Well, I'm glad to have you on with me, Daryl. Where are you, sir?
I'm in Spokane, Washington.
Oh, always a pleasure to hear from our friends there. What can I do for you?
Well, I've got what I consider a major problem. I live on the South Hill. I have a yard which is pretty much sunny all day long. And about half of it is planted, the other half is grass. And in the center of my yard, I've got a large Japanese dogwood plant. And on both sides, I've got a planting area. One, I've got lilies, Asiatic and Oriental lilies. And on the other side, I've got perennials. Well, a couple of years ago, while I was in the nursery, I decided I need a little more color. I have a lot of blue and other colors. So what I did is I bought four Coreopsis, and they were no different than the other ones that seemed to be in there, the smaller buds. And so the next spring, would you believe, the whole perennial area was covered with Coreopsis.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think anybody who's ever grown it would believe that.
I got two 32-gallon garbage cans full of them. Now, every year since, just like this year, I pulled up so far this year at least 10. But the problem is that they grow right in the middle of these perennial plants.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have to do in most cases is dig the plants up and separate them and then prepare the soil and put the plant back in again. And over the years, the plants that I have in the planting area have grown larger. So they're getting to be less space for me to kneel on, you know, to pull up the plants. So I'm trying to figure, how do I get rid of these darn things? These are more like a weed instead of a plant. As a matter of fact, I looked on the website one day, and I see that they recommend them putting these things on a bare hillside, and that they cover rather rapidly, which I can guarantee.
So your choices here are few, and they all involve labor, because even if you were going to use herbicides, you know, conventional ones or organic ones, it's very difficult to not kill the plants you want to save.
Right.
So what most people would suggest, what the two things the Rodale Institute has done when they've had a really invasive grass invade beds of perennials is they very carefully transplanted the perennials to a new bed or a holding bed or healed them in early in the springtime and then tried to weed, you know, in your case, the Coreopsis out, but not replanting right away. After that, you would have two choices. Now, you're in Spokane, which is not Seattle. You get some nice, hot, dry summers, right?
Sort of a high desert area.
Right. So what you could do, and I think you still have time, if you got all your perennials out of there and heal them in, put them in a separate planting for a year, you know, do something different with them, put them in pots, whatever you would need to do, then you could scalp that area to the ground, level it out, saturate it with water, and pull clear plastic, 2 mil plastic, over top of that area, seal the edges down with bricks, and the sun would solarize that soil and kill all the root hairs and all the weed seeds that are in the soil. Then in the fall, you could replant your perennials, and you should be free of the Coreopsis. Your other option would be the same thing. Get out all the perennials that you can. You can say put them someplace else and then level that area, you know, mow it down with a mower set on, dirt blowing out the back of the mower, and then pile probably like 5 or 6 inches of wood chips on top of that area and leave that in place until the following spring to really smother the plants. And, you know, one thing I can assure you of, Darren, we've all had either this weed or a similar one in our garden. Now, your Coreopsis is very attractive. It is a great plant for native bees. That's the perfect color to attract pollinators. So there's nothing wrong with it. It's just interfering with what you want to do. Your other option would be to get your wanted plants out of there, drive in really deep edging, and accept the fact that you have a big patch of Coreopsis. It is a beautiful plant, right?
Yeah, but I like what I have in there. I like the variety. That's the main thing.
Yes, but you also have to understand that without doing a lot of work, you are standing outside your door screaming up to the sky, "Hey, nature, I'm tougher than you. I'm going to beat you up." And you know how those fights end.
Well, I see you've given me the option. I've got to figure out what I want to do.
Yes, solarize or smother are your two big ones. Although the third option, again, is to establish the Coreopsis, is to allow the Coreopsis to survive, drive deep edging all around it to keep it in its place, and it'll attract lots of pollinators for your other plants.
Is this typical of a specific type of coreopsis, or is this true of all of them?
From what I've read in my emails and phone calls, it's true of all of them.
Well, I'll be darned. I'll be darned. Well, I certainly appreciate your help, and I enjoy listening to your program.
All right. Well, good luck, Darryl. You got your work cut out for you.
Thank you very much.
Take care, man. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Heirloom rhubarb versus Oklahoma summers. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started by reading this week's perplexing question.
Sure, Mike. Megan, who's moving from Broomfield, Colorado to Northeast Oklahoma, writes, "We really want to take our rhubarb with us. The plants have been passed down through my husband's family and have been in the ground here in Colorado for 16 years. We're just now harvesting this season's crop. I understand from reading the article on rhubarb at your website's A to Z Answers section that we'll need to plant them in an area that's protected from the afternoon sun in their new, warmer climate. But what should we do with the clumps when we arrive in Oklahoma around August 1st? Should we store them in a cool, dark place and plant them later in the fall? I really don't want to leave these family plants behind, but it sounds like our timing is all wrong."
Ah, yeah, rhubarb, the ultimate garden oddity. It's perennial, and it's the only vegetable we use like a fruit. A relative of buckwheat, it produces stalks that make a delicious pie filling when cooked up with lots of sugar, but you have to be careful to trim off every little bit of the poisonous leaves.
That's why you only ever see the stalks for sale in grocery stores and never the leaves.
Yeah, the leaves are nicely ornamental, however. It's a fun visual extra for gardeners who grow rhubarb, but you really do have to be careful to trim every little bit off before you use the stalk. At any rate, this is a difficult question. Rhubarb is a seriously cool climate crop that grows best in the north. The further north, the better, like all the way up in Minnesota. It typically doesn't survive the hot summers of the south.
So you can't grow rhubarb in places like Oklahoma and Texas?
Oh, you can grow it. People who move down to these areas from the north often miss fresh rhubarb so much in the spring that they'll grow it as an annual. They'll plant a big clump outdoors in the fall, or they'll start plants indoors early like tomatoes and then move them outside in time for a nice harvest that spring. But in most areas in the south, those plants are going to burn up right after that in the summer heat. Now, yes, sometimes the plants can survive to produce again the following year, especially if that summer happens to be on the cool side, the rhubarb is planted in a spot that gets a lot of afternoon shade, and it gets watered heavily during hot and dry spells. But survival in the south is always going to be the exception, never the rule.
And in this case, that rule would mean the end of the line for a family heirloom.
Right, so I emailed Megan back to ask what's going to happen to the property she's moving away from. She answered that they'll be renting it out and added, quote, "Are you thinking I could have somebody dig the clumps up in the fall and send them to me to plant when it's cooler in Oklahoma?"
No, that might provide a harvest next spring, but wouldn't solve the long-term problem.
Right, we need something more clever than that. So I kept asking questions. Do you have renters ready to move in? Do you know them? And do you intend to return to this house at some point? She responded that she didn't have any specific renters yet, but, quote, "We've rented this home out many times, and our experience has been that renters tend not to be very adept at gardening. The rhubarbs are some of the few plants that have survived despite obvious neglect."
She also added that they do plan to return to Colorado periodically to visit family.
So here's the plan. Come back in the fall after you get settled in Oklahoma. Dig up the clumps and divide each clump into halves or quarters.
Shouldn't this be done every 5 years or so to keep the rhubarb productive?
Exactly. Now, plant some of those new divisions at the homes of trusted friends or family and reinstall a few of them back at the original house. Then either time one of your visits back home to Colorado to coincide with peak rhubarb season, and or have the new caretakers of your plants overnight half of each harvest to you. You'll be the envy of everybody in Oklahoma.
And this isn't specific to just rhubarb, right? You'd give pretty much the same advice to people in similar situations with other kinds of plants.
Yeah, you don't want to move a plant that has a precious family history to a part of the country where it's almost guaranteed to die a terrible death.
Well, Megan loves the answer. You emailed her a rough outline of your plan and she responded, "That's perfect. Thank you so much for, quote, getting it."
Oh, and you know, our previous article on rhubarb that she mentioned includes a link to a video of a woman in the UK who forces rhubarb indoors for an early harvest. So if the new place in Oklahoma has a cool cellar, they might want to take one of the clumps out with them and try that technique as well. Well, those sure were some great ideas about leaving your rhubarb and having it too, now wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to ruin my rhubarb if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, refuse teeming towards our garden shore, at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location or we will just go back and forth and you'll never get an answer to your question. Or visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about where you are and where you will probably find the answers to all of those garden questions you are going to email us. Audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar keep our website happily perennial. To the best of our knowledge, the leaves of Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, are not toxic. Our editor, Al Banks, well, those leaves may be toxic. Our ephemeral intern is Mary Rose. We welcome Emma Bixler to the morning zoo here. I'm your tender perennial Mike McGrath, and I would not have survived Oklahoma personally if the hotel hadn't finally closed the bar at 3 a.m. So 5 will get you 10 at Woolworths, and I'll see you here again next week. Mums are technically perennial, but they rarely look good their second season. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how to make second-year mums look like first-class plants. Plus your fabulous phone calls.